From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We've talked a lot on our show about those elusive superdelegates. Those are the almost 800 elected officials and political VIPs who could ultimately decide who the Democrats will send into the general election for the White House. But the conversation about superdelegates comes with baggage. Some think the top-tier Democrats should vote the way their constituents voted. Well, now you can count Georgia Congressman John Lewis among those ranks.
As a superdelegate to the Democratic Convention, I will be casting my vote for Barack Obama.
Yesterday, Lewis gave an exclusive interview with Atlanta TV reporter Monica Pearson, and he told her that he's switching his support from Hillary Clinton to Barack Obama. With me now is Monica Pearson, news anchor for WSB-TV in Atlanta, Georgia. Monica, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
So you interviewed Congressman Lewis yesterday. Did you know in advance that he was going to tell you this?
No. When I was called and told that Congressman Lewis needed to see me in Washington, that he was doing three interviews, one with NBC, one with us, and one with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, I kind of guessed that it might have something to do with him switching. But really, there were three options, and his three options were to stay with Mrs. Clinton, switch to Mr. Obama, or to return to the uncommitted column. So I prepared for all three eventualities.
Now, did he give you a sense of why he chose the option he did?
Yes. I guess I could describe it really the easiest way. When he originally endorsed Mrs. Clinton, it was in October of last year. If you look back to that time, in October of last year, Mrs. Clinton was seen as the front runner. Senator Clinton was probably going to get the nomination. Mr. Obama was the newcomer. Also at that time, a CNN poll showed that black Americans by 57% were strongly in favor of Mrs. Clinton. But that same poll by January showed that black Americans now were only supporting her by 31%. So from October to January, the playing field changed. He also told me that he really saw, in not only in his constituents, but across the country, both young blacks and young whites were being drawn to Obama. I use the phrase Obama Nation, the fact that it has become a nation of people who are saying, we want that change. So here is a man who had been an icon and is an icon in the civil rights movement and knows what it's like to, quote, fight the system and make change possible. He said when he saw Obama and saw what he was doing to young people and the nation, there was no choice but to change. Now, let me explain to you. He also said that it was one of the most difficult decisions he's ever made because of his long-standing friendship and respect for former President Clinton and Senator Clinton. He said, and I couldn't believe it when he did say it, but he said, this was more difficult than walking across the Edmund Pettus Bridge 43 years ago and getting beaten up.
Which he did severely.
Which he did. But he said that he, quote, I'm a big boy, and even though I know I would be criticized, I have to do what I know is right, not only for myself, but for my constituents.
Yeah, and he is someone who, marching across the Edmund Pettus Bridge when peaceful civil rights marchers were absolutely just had the dogs and the batons turned on them. It was a real turning point in the civil rights movement. So for him to say this, it seems as if in some way he sees this as part of his civil rights legacy.
He does see it as part of a civil rights legacy. I asked him, what do you think Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. would think of what is happening right now in politics and what is happening in particular with the Obama campaign? And he said, I know he's sitting somewhere and he's smiling because this is that beloved community he wanted to create. This is that interracial democracy that he wanted to create. And he really was very, you know, John Lewis I've known for 33 years in covering news in Atlanta, and he was very emotional about it. This to him was a major decision that needed to be made. He was receiving all kinds of criticism, and I actually asked him how much pressure was applied, and he said there was no pressure from either the Clinton camp or the Obama camp, that he did hear from citizens on both sides, you know, you should stay where you are supporting Hillary, or you should switch to Obama because of your race. the decision, he said, was made on principle.
Now, when you say switch to Obama because of your race, you're talking about the fact that he's being challenged for his seat in the House of Representatives.
Yes, Markell Hutchins, who is a young minister here and has been very involved in civil rights here, is challenging Mr. Lewis this time. And I asked John if that had some bearing on it. He said, absolutely not. This is not the first person who has run against him, and it won't be the last. He said this decision was made based on reality. I did ask him, did he think he had endorsed Mrs. Clinton too early? And he realistically and honestly looked at me and said, you know, when I look back at it, it maybe would have been better for me to remain uncommitted. Because, as you know, many delegates go to the convention uncommitted. They don't endorse anyone. And he said, you know, at the time, she was my choice. And I still respect her and want us to still be friends at the end of this. But in the end, you have to do what your constituents want. And when you see what is happening with Obama rolling across the nation and changing people's attitudes about government, he said he felt he had to do it.
Now, Congressman Lewis has been largely mum since the announcement. We tried several times to reach him directly, and it seems as if he made a great effort to reach out to you as a local broadcaster and to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Why do you think it was important for him to make this statement to the home team?
He could probably answer that much better than I could if he would answer it. I think, to be quite honest, he called people he knows and has known for a long time. I've been anchoring in Atlanta now for 33 years. And before that, I was a television reporter and a newspaper reporter at the Courier-Journal in Louisville Times in Louisville, Kentucky. So I've been doing this literally since 1969. So I think he called on people he knows and he knows would be fair. It was not easy with me, you know, asking him and being very blunt with him, you know, are you doing this? Are you giving in to the criticism? And is this a case of, you know, someone's called you a sellout because you had not supported Mr. Obama until now? And raising those questions. But that's what we get paid to do. And he knows that we would treat him fairly.
Now, what about this whole sellout issue? I'm not going to ask this about Representative Lewis directly, but there are a lot of complicated racial dynamics around whether or not you're choosing a white woman, a black man, a white man, and whether or not it relates to your identity. Atlanta is one of these places where black identity is defined and redefined constantly. What kind of word on the street are you hearing about how people view Senator Obama, his blackness, their blackness, whether or not there should be some loyalty based on race?
Well, that, I think, is the big question of the entire race, of the entire, quote, race, the political race. For the first time in our history, those of us who are twofers, who are women and also African-American, how do you choose? Well, I think it's answered very simply, and this is the discussion that's had here, and people have to constantly remember, and I think you see it with Reverend Lowry having in the beginning supported Mr. Obama, and Andrew Young in the beginning supporting Hillary Clinton, while our mayor of the city, who is a mentor, you know, mentee of Ambassador Young, again supporting Hillary Clinton. Supporting Obama. She supports Obama. What you're seeing is people are having to say, let's strip away the outer cover of female and color African American, or in the case of Governor Richardson when he was running, Hispanic heritage. Strip away the veneer and let's talk about issues and how your stand on those issues affect and reflect my ethics, my morals, my way that I want to live. And we as black people always want to be supportive of each other. And in this instance, which is what Representative Lewis was talking about, creating that beloved community that is interracial means you have to choose people not based on color, but on intellect, ideals, and how your feelings match theirs. And that's very hard to do for some people because they don't want to be labeled an Uncle Tom, a sellout, or you're not supporting your own people, when it's not about that. What it's about is choosing the best fit for you philosophically. And that is what I think has so many people in this race been out of shape, because they can't say, well, I really prefer this person over the other, and it has nothing to do with gender or race.
What about just, you know, whatever thoughts you have on how what a city like Atlanta is looking for from the next presidency, i.e., is the city wanting...
Now, let me explain something to you first. We talk about the city of Atlanta, but the city of Atlanta is just that. We are living in the state of Georgia, which has a Republican governor.
How does that affect the dynamic?
And remember that outside basically Fulton County and DeKalb County, you're looking at a lot of Republican administration. We have a growing number of Republicans in the state of Georgia. So what's good about that is that the political mix here is very good. Makes for great coverage. So, as goes, I guess you'd say, the primary, so will go the state in the national election. Unless it depends on who the Republican candidate is.
All right.
And if it's Mr. McCain, which we think it will be, and there is talk that our governor, Sonny Perdue, is on a list of possible vice presidential candidates. So it's going to be interesting to watch from the Georgia perspective.
Well, Monica, thanks again.
You are more than welcome.
Monica Pearson is a news anchor for WSB-TV in Atlanta, Georgia. If you go to our site, nprnewsandnotes.org, you'll find link to all the video of her interview. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. From Burkina Faso, West Africa, to Baldwin Hills, Los Angeles, African and Black diaspora film festivals are popping up all year round, all over the world. Some just run for a day or two, while others are sprawling, star-studded international affairs. Stop by one of these and you can catch more than 100 flicks from all over the globe. The festivals are good places for Black artists to showcase their movie-making skills. They're networking hotspots, too. Places to rub elbows, share fresh ideas, and maybe even pull down a nice piece for your price. As part of a month-long series on Blacks in film, we're looking at African diaspora film festivals. One estimate says there are more than 20 Black film festivals each year in the United States alone, many of them with a global focus. One of the biggest is in New York, another in Los Angeles. Asentewa Olatunje is the program director for the Los Angeles Pan-African Film and Arts Festival, and Reynaldo Barroso Spech, he's co-founder of Art Matan, which puts on the African Diaspora Film Festival in New York. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Asentewa, let me start with you. You wrapped up your 16th Pan-African Film and Arts Festival. When you started the festival, you came in as a lawyer. Explain that.
Yes, I'm a lawyer by profession. But like most lawyers, you know, we all have scripts in our bottom drawers or something. Any rate, in addition to being a lawyer, I've always been somewhat of a community activist. And I am actually one of the founders also of the Pan-African Film Festival. And I had taken a vacation to Africa. I was working in a law office at the time, and I sent back an overview postcard of the city of Dakar with the city. And when I got back, my secretary, who also happened to have been Black, told me, you should have been here when you sent that postcard back. This was not a Black firm. And I said, why? What happened? She says, everybody was saying, I thought you went to Africa. There are no cities in Africa.
Uh-oh.
Right. And so it just became obvious to me. I mean, these were lawyers and, you know, educated people. And they were under this complete misconception, you know, the Tarzan images, the famine, you know, the wars, et cetera. And they really had no conception of the Africa that I knew. So
Let me ask, what was the first step that you took on a business level to really work on the festival here in Los Angeles? I mean, before you even get started in something this big, you must have to put together a plan. How did you plan it?
Well, it's amazing to me now because we knew so little about it. I mean, our first thing was to go and speak to people who had film festivals. One of our big helpers was actually, at the time, the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival here. They gave us a lot of information on just how to get started, notes, forms, all sorts of things of that nature. We had gone to several film festivals prior to, and we also, in my case, it was the first thing was to file a 501c3 nonprofit.
Yeah, when you think about all these things, I'm going to get Ronaldo into this. Ronaldo, was it ever daunting to you as an individual to say, I've got to balance my creative side with my business side, and what do I need to know on a business side?
Yes, it did. I mean, from the very beginning. The thing is that it was so complicated that we kind of postponed it, and we reached that level later. But yes, we understood that from the very beginning, the film festival was a business, and we needed to have a business plan. That came out of visiting some other festivals in and out of the country, and then we quickly understood that this is a business that we must put together and serve our communities.
Well, let's talk about some of the films. Both of your festivals are similar in that they're international. And Asantewaa, the film Return to Gori, won your competition for Best Documentary. Let's take a little listen to that film, Return to Gori.
At the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, there's a railroad made of human bones, black ivory.
And I know it will be successful because quite a few things have happened to me since I've been here spiritually.
It's real dramatic to me, you know. It's just overwhelming to be able to experience something that I thought I never would have experienced.
So what are we listening to there?
You are listening to, one was Amiri Baraka and another group of African Americans who were sought out by the great musician Youssou N'Dour from Senegal. And Mr. N'Dour felt the need to come to the United States to make that middle passage and explore for himself how culture has been transported from Africa to the United States, and to gather up with him those purveyors of culture, musicians, artists, poets, and bring them back to Africa. In this case, it was Gori, and they did an incredible concert on the Isle of Gori, which Gori, as many of your listeners may know, is it was a transport island where captives were taken from Africa, boarded on ships and brought, you know, through the Middle Passage into the Americas.
What do you hope to get in terms of an audience when you air a film like this? Who are you trying to reach?
Well, we're trying to reach everyone, specifically, I mean, black people, of course, but everyone. A film like this actually works on many ways, aside from being just an incredible, offering in terms of art and musicianship. Culture. It's also a statement that dispels many of the myths that we often hear here in terms of the separations between continental-born Africans and Africans born here in the United States. As an African-American, we're often told people in Africa don't care about you. Well, films like this show another story.
Ronaldo, you actually have a very, very international background. Cuban-born, Haitian and Jamaican parents. Your wife and business partner, Diara, is French with roots in Mali. You're both operating this in New York City. How does who you are affect how you approach programming your festival?
Well, I mean, let me piggyback on what Asantewaa was saying. Hi, Asantewaa, how are you?
Hi, Ronaldo.
Return to Gori is one of the films that our company has for distribution now. This is a film that when we saw for the first time really touched us deeply at many levels. And then we were able to gather the financial strength to buy it and bring it into the United States. That film tells you how we see the work we do and how deeply we want to go into this. I am my training is that of a teacher. I mean, I began teaching foreign languages many years ago, and I realized very quickly that it was necessary for many of the students to associate the languages that were studying in the classroom and the people who spoke those languages. Because in the case of French, for example, it is very hard for many people, even today, to accept that people in Africa speak very good French, and many good poets and writers in the French language are not born in France. They are born in Martinique, in Guadeloupe, in Côte d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, and other places. So that was one of the main goals we had in our festival. Through programming, we have been able, I think, to convey that message of diversity and richness in the world of the African diaspora.
Before we move on any further, I want to make sure that anyone just tuning in is with us on this journey. You're listening to News and Notes, NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We were just hearing from Reynaldo Barroso Spech. He is the co-founder of New York's African Diaspora Film Festival. And we also have Asentewa Olatunje. She's the program director for the Los Angeles Pan-African Film and Arts Festival. Yes,
we're actually just the Pan-African Film Festival, because we also do a festival in Atlanta.
So this is the film festival, and then the arts festival is done as a branch of the same organization, or?
Well, in Atlanta, we're part of the National Black Arts Festival, and it's actually a festival within a festival. The Pan-African Film Festival is the guest of the Atlanta National Black Arts Festival. We do the programming of the films.
So, Asentewa, how easy is it to cross-promote your work with other organizations? Are they open? And then, Reynaldo, I'll ask you the same thing. Cultural institutions.
It's not hard. I mean, if you take, for example, our situation in Atlanta, we were actually sought out by the folks who put the Atlanta Festival on and invited to come, because they understand. They try to do the same thing in terms of music and dance and other cultural forms. So they also wanted that international flavor with the films that they wanted to present.
Reynaldo, what about finding partners? Who do you consider your allies in this work?
Well, at this moment, the festival moves around the country and international as well. And we have host organizations in Jersey City, the Jersey City Museum. In Chicago, we work with Facet Cinematheque. And in Washington, D.C., with Trans-Africa Forum. Those are nationally host organization that help us promoting and putting together a festival, an African diaspora film festival in those cities. And internationally, we have been working for the past 5 years with people in Curacao, in the Caribbean, in the Dutch Caribbean, and there with the collaboration of House of Culture, which is a grassroots organization, and other groups, we have been able to be there for the past 6 years with the festival. And Amel, I forgot to say that as we speak, the Best of the African Diaspora Film Festival is taking place at BAM here in New York, and today will be the last day. This is another event that here in New York we were able to approach the institution, and they said yes, and for the past 7 years we have the Best of the African Diaspora Film Festival during the month of February in BAM.
Well, you know, speaking of your selections in your festival, I want to talk about a specific one called A Winter Tale. Here's a clip from it.
June 17th, 2002.
Don't go there.
7:45 p.m.
What does that have to do with anything?
Julian, Sebeka, and Lloyd.
Look, I'm dead. I'm buried. It is over. Finish. Done. I have to learn to live with it.
They shot him because he was selling drugs, Mom.
I don't want to hear this.
Selling drugs to kids in the park. You're a golden scholarship boy turning our community into addicts. You can deny it all you want, but everyone knows it except you.
Now, that is set in the West Indian community in Toronto. Tell me a little bit more about the film, Reynaldo.
Well, the film opened our film festival here in New York City. And one of the things that hit me when I saw it for the first time, I have been several times in Toronto, in Montreal. I mean, I know those cities very well because both have festivals that we attend. But this is the first time that we were exposed to a film going deep into the African descent community there, to be specific, the Afro-Caribbean community, and show some of the problems that we can see in other cities of the world. And this is a film that very well backs up the idea that we have in the festival, that we want to show the global black experience. There are many things that people of African descent go through all over the world, and it's independently of the language, the colonizer at the beginning of their history and things like that, you realize that there are common things, and this is a film that deals with that. And not only that, this is a film that presents a group of men trying to go into themselves and reach out to their humanity and be better human beings against all odds. In places like Toronto, where we usually have a very idyllic image of Canada, and that place, like everybody's very happy here and nothing really bad happens.
Asantewaa, is this meant to serve a purpose, like knitting together a global diaspora, or is this meant to be entertainment, or is it meant to be business? How do you see this festival, PAFF? What's its vision and mission?
It's all of those things. I mean, obviously, it's a business. It takes resources in order to get these films here and have them on a screen, present them on a screen, and let people know that they are here. They have to be entertaining because, of course, you know, people don't want to come and see something that, you know, is not going to entertain or at least inform them, and it's informative. One of the things when we started the Pan-African Film Festival was to explore the differences as well as the similarities of people of African descent throughout the world. At the time, we had very little opportunity to actually know each other. There's not a lot of media about people of African descent in other places. I mean, we know that there are people in, you know, black people in Brazil. Of course, there's black people in Africa, Europe, Caribbean, throughout North America. But there was very little information that was accessible to the majority of our people about each other.
I have to jump in. We have very little time. Rinaldo, do you think that your festival and your traveling series is making a difference in how people see the world?
I think so. I think we have made a difference in New York City to begin with, and we have made a difference in all those cities because, as Asantewaa well said, we are serving communities that even though are linked, they didn't know much about each other. And in the case of FESPACO, for example, the festival in Ouagadougou in Burkina Faso, I have been instrumental in taking to that festival in more than one occasion films about the Afro-Latino experience, because I remember speaking with the director of the festival and he told me, we don't know anything about black people in Spanish-speaking and Portuguese-speaking countries. And I said, well, I can help you with that because I know the area and I have connections in that area. And I remember when this past festival, we took to the festival a film about Maria Bethânia, a very important Brazilian singer. And in the past, we have taken films to that festival from Cuba, Jamaica, all the places.
Okay, we have to wrap it up, but I have to say there's some amazing films out there. Rinaldo, Asantewaa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're speaking with Rinaldo Barroso Spech, co-founder of Art Matan, which puts on the African Diaspora Film Festival in New York. He's on the line from our studios in New York. And Asantewaa Olatunje, program director for the Los Angeles Pan-African Film Festival. She's here with me at our NPR West studios. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's Thursday, and time again for a look at the week in sports with our very own Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai. So here's our sports question of the day. Can an athlete be so dominant in one sport that he or she becomes bad for the sport itself? What do you think?
It sounds like an SAT essay question to me.
Well, I'll let you pass on that one because it is what some people who follow golf are actually saying about Tiger Woods, who's been on a tear so far this year. And that is the first topic we put to our sports analyst, New York Times columnist Bill Roden. Hey, Bill, nice to talk to you.
Oh, great. Tony Cox.
Well, okay. 8 weeks into the PGA Tour season, and Tiger has won everything that he has played. He is on an incredible pace, and people are actually, Bill Roden, talking about the possibility of a perfect season. Now, I don't know about that, but I do know this. Some golf writers are suggesting that Tiger's terrific tournament stretch may be bad for the sport. Now, why? Because when he's on the course, they're saying the winner is a foregone conclusion. And to follow that point, golfer Hal Sutton said just this week that he was watching Tiger last Sunday, quote, until I got bored. What do you make of all this?
Sour grapes. That's what I make out of it. I mean, have you heard such a thing, you know, that somebody begins to deride excellence and dominance? I mean, I think that's sort of what's wrong in competitive sports. Is, you know, particularly in the NFL where they talk about parity and parity. I think sometimes you need this dominant force, this Attila the Hun, that's so dominant that everybody else is chasing and sets the standards. Now, I mean, Tiger is a phenomenal story probably of, I don't want to say the entire century, but certainly of the last part of the 20th century. His dominance is unparalleled. And to Hal Sutton, those guys, I have one thing to say, get better.
Now, there is something to the idea of rooting for the underdog. And you mentioned the NFL. I think about the Patriots and how the country was beginning to root against them as they were getting closer to a perfect season. There's a parallel, isn't there, between that and this with Tiger?
Well, you know, I think the thing that's so interesting about Tiger, whether you call him an African-American or a person of color, whatever, is just so uncanny that you've got a guy who's been such a Pied Piper in golf, brought so many people to the golf course, that in a way you still pull form even in his near perfection. I mean, he's just so ahead of the crowd. I mean, it's really unprecedented. And yes, would it be great if he'd had a rival? You know, well, I'm sure somebody in 10 years,
somebody will pick him up. But you know what? Probably not at the Arnold Palmer Invitational, which is his next tournament coming up on the 13th of March. Let's move on to another topic, because here's a follow-up to a topic that we hit the last time you were on, and we talked about baseball, steroids, and the appearance of Roger Clemens and Brian McNamee before a congressional committee. And you said then that you thought this should go to the Justice Department for an investigation of perjury against Clemens. Well, Bill, looks like you were right. The committee has now sent a letter to the DOJ requesting a probe into whether Clemens did in fact lie under oath about taking steroids. It is the same accusation that got Barry Bonds indicted. Here's what's interesting, though. The committee did not ask Justice to look into whether McNamee was lying. So what does this all mean?
Well, it means Roger Clemens is facing an 0-2 count, you know, with a 3-out bottom of the ninth. You know, it does not look good. It does not look good for him. And now we still have the specter of a presidential pardon, you know, but on the facts of it, on the merit, he is right where he's supposed to be. He is in Barry Bonds territory. And to be honest with you, Tony, it somewhat looks worse, because now, you know, we're talking about the governor's witness is Brian McNamee, is sort of not only an eyewitness, but he said, I did it. I did it several times. So I think a lot of the Congress people were looking at the way I was looking at it and said, you know what, Roger, you got to be kidding me. This is, you know, the nanny whole thing. You can't even tell the truth about your nanny. You know, you say you weren't at the party and your nanny says you were there and you stayed there. So, yeah, Tony, I mean, this does not look good for Roger Dodger.
All right, more trouble for a guy in another sport, college basketball. Hoop fans know that Indiana University basketball coach Kelvin Sampson resigned Friday amid allegations of 5 potential major NCAA violations, including the coach lying to IU and to NCAA investigators about making wrong recruitment telephone calls. What makes it worse is that this is the very same thing that he got in trouble with when he was coaching at Oklahoma, said he wouldn't do it again. Apparently he did. He received a $750,000 buyout from IU, $550,000 of which came from an anonymous donor. Bill, did the punishment fit the crime?
First of all, I'm not an NCAA fan. I think that this whole thing of, you know, the semi-pro on-campus entertainment in the name of football, basketball is just completely fraudulent. You know, where student-athletes are on a plantation, have no rights, you know, can't move around freely like the coaches, can't get shoe contracts, you know, money from shoe contracts, you know, while the coaches are, you know, making money from radio, TV, and all that. So I think the whole premise of it, Tony, is fraudulent, you know. So, I think that anything he got was really unfair. But he did the same thing at Oklahoma. I like Kelvin Sampson. I think he's a good guy. He had Indiana. It's a tragedy that he had Indiana playing great. I mean, Indiana was playing really wonderful. Why Kelvin? I guess he's just like a lot of our children are addicted to cell phones.
Likes to text. Huh?
He just likes to text. Come on, Kelvin, cut out the text messaging.
Well, we wanted to get to one more topic, but time has run out. We will have to talk about the NCAA and the rankings and the seedings heading in to March Madness when we get back with you next time.
Hey, look forward to it.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, Tony. Take care.
That was NPR's Tony Cox talking with William C. Roden. Roden is a sports columnist for the New York Times and author of $40 Million Slaves, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of the Black Athlete. Most of us have had a day where we think, I just can't take it anymore. Some folks have headaches and some get migraines, a whole different force factor of pain. You may know Pam Oliver as a sportscaster for TNT. She's also a member of the Black Women's Health Imperative, and migraines are something she knows about personally. Hi, Pam.
Hi, Farai. How are you? Don't forget my day job, Fox Sports.
Fox Sports. Okay.
That's my day job.
Absolutely appreciate it. So tell me about your struggle with migraines. Have you always dealt with them?
Oh, man. It seems for most of my life, I've had these issues with migraines. Really, I can say definitively for the last 20 years. I'm 47. So I noticed there was one point in my life just I had to take a leave of absence for Rye because I could not literally shake what I thought was a common headache. I just felt like, oh, I get these bad headaches and I'm just prone to bad headaches. Well, you know, it turned out, you know, all this time later, I finally got the diagnosis that I was suffering from migraine headaches, which are a whole different animal. If you have a migraine, if you're a migraine sufferer, you can feel my pain. You know what I'm talking about. It's not the common, oh, you know, a little tension here, a little pressure here. It is really quite debilitating. And that's kind of what separates them from what you would call an ordinary headache.
Is there any kind of difference in how often people have headaches or for what when they're Black women?
Black women particularly are prone, for whatever reason, to migraine headaches. They are, however, the last people to get treatment, to go out and seek help for migraines. And I think that's probably, you know, something that's maybe a little bit cultural, or, you know, we feel we have to be tough and strong and can't afford to lose work, and all sorts of issues kind of tumble into that. But for whatever reason, Black women are the last to get treatment. And I really hope that changes. It doesn't have to be. You don't have to, you know, literally be shut off in a dark room. You know what, Farai? I actually own a pair of blackout curtains. That's pathetic, isn't it?
But well,
it
just tell us exactly why that helps by blocking out the light.
It helps if you're a person who suffers from migraines. You find yourself to be completely insensitive, or your tolerance of light is definitely acute. You're not the same. It bothers you. There are other triggers, whether it's chocolate or cheese or certain types of foods. It's kind of all over the place, and the symptoms depend on the individual. But for me, I found that it was kind of sometimes an issue with light that tumbled into something else, maybe, you know, whatever that food or beverage was. I hadn't quite narrowed it down to figure out what exactly my triggers are. I just know that I always have to fight really to try to stay one step ahead of it. If I have the symptoms of a migraine, I found something that has worked for me because it's specific for migraines. It takes care of the migraine as opposed to just sort of popping all of these things, not knowing, you know, if they really work. For whatever reason, this medication that's migraine specific medication was something that has helped me to be able to keep, you know, a couple of steps ahead of a migraine.
So as a sportscaster, that's not exactly a blackout curtain. I'm going to just have a quiet moment away from the world occupation. So what happens? Sure. Have you ever had moments where you just said, I can't work?
No. You know what? I had those moments early in my career where I really had no choice. I couldn't get out of bed. I couldn't see straight. All sorts of things were happening. But as I finally got a hold of them and got the proper diagnosis that I was a migraine sufferer, then, I was able to find something that worked. But there had been plenty of times, plenty of games where I'm standing there, 80,000 people are screaming, bright sunlight, and I'm just going, could they just hold it down a little bit? You know, and you're not going to get, 80,000, ticket holders to hold it down. So, you just kind of figured out, some days I've toughed it out. Some days I've gone on air with a very bad migraine, because that's my job.
Has anyone ever just run a tackle into you by accident, shaken up your brain, anything awful?
I have never been sideline roadkill. I've made it a point to always know where the action is and to not get caught up in it. There are times, though, when my back is turned, I'm doing a stand-up, for example, and you could see everybody, their eyes are getting big, and they're just kind of like, my cameraman's really good about pulling me out of the way. So, no, I haven't had any kind of brain scramble to that extent, but I can see where you're going. A lot of these players who suffer from concussions, eventually, sometimes they can turn into migraine sufferers as well.
Well, before we let you go, tell us about the Black Women's Health Imperative. How did you get involved, and what are you guys trying to do?
Oh, it's just a wonderful organization. It's a national not-for-profit organization that's devoted to tackling health issues as it relates to Black women and girls. BlackWomen'sHealth.org is the place to go. You can find out more information about all sorts of health issues that we all sort of are subjected to, and it's a wonderful place to kind of go and find out all sorts of things, particularly about migraines. But headachequiz.com, if I could just say that, it's a tremendous website. It'll walk you through all of the signs and the symptoms, so you can take that information, take it to your doctor, and say, can we possibly look at this, as opposed to just sort of blindly going through saying, oh, I have a bad headache, or do I have a sinus headache, which, by the way, medically, there is no such thing.
Well,
so
Pam,
Black women out there are, suffering through these things, and you really don't have to.
Pam, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Pam Oliver is a sports reporter for Fox Sports and also for TNT, and she joined us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. It's Thursday and time to crack open the mailbag. Joining me now to sort through your letters is producer and editor Christopher Johnson. Hey, Christopher, what's up first?
Hey, Farai, what's up? We got a letter about our Africa update on Tuesday. NPR's Tony Cox was hosting that day, and he talked to Bill Fletcher about the recent indictment of 40 Rwandan officers. They were involved in that country's genocide in the 90s. Bill explained why the men were being tried in a Spanish court.
The technical reason that Spain is prosecuting them has to do with the murder of some Spaniards in Rwanda. And they may have been murdered, executed, or so-called collateral damage in the war that was going on between the Rwandan Patriotic Front and the Hutu perpetrators of the genocide.
Listener Janice Yoon says Bill missed a point in his explanation. Janice writes, I couldn't help but cringe yesterday when I heard Tony Cox's guest speaking on the indictment of 40 Rwandans. Spain indicted those men under its broad universal jurisdiction, which allows Spain to prosecute international crimes committed beyond its borders.
And Ann Slater in Ardmore, Pennsylvania, wrote in about Tony's interview with two Black female filmmakers. Ann says, I really enjoyed Tony Cox's interview with Casey Lemons and Nima Barnett. I enjoyed Eve's Bayou several months ago and look forward to seeing more of both women's films. I applaud their portrayals of the true Black American experience. They push aside the stereotypical gangster rap or sweet old Black man / woman / little girl that are too often served up to the American public.
And last Friday, we ran Jeff Obafemi-Carr's commentary on the N-word. He tried to see the word from all sides, as a controversial slur and as a show of brotherly love. John Gaithers in Athens, Georgia, tuned in and sent us this. Thank you for this insightful and amusing commentary. I believe it goes to the heart of the issue of distinguishing between words and the meaning of those words. Its comical repetition of the N-word satirizes the futility of using substitute words as a means of social change.
On our Sports Bloggers Roundtable last week, we talked about black folks showing more and more love for the Boston Celtics. Listener Andrew McFarlane in Miami is crying foul on that one. He says we left out some key former black Celtic greats. Andrew writes, I lived in Boston for most of the 80s and watched a lot of Celtics basketball. I was very surprised at your discussion of the team failed to even mention Dennis Johnson, the very definition of a clutch big game point guard, or Robert Parrish, who only managed to make it to the Hall of Fame. If Larry Bird got more attention than anyone else on the team, it was because he was one of the greatest players to ever step on a basketball court.
And finally, Farai, a little love in Espanol. We got an email from Jose Garcia de Paso in Toledo. Not Toledo, Ohio, but Toledo, Spain. Jose writes, I listen to several daily radio shows on NPR. I have to say that News and Notes podcast has become my favorite one, thanks to Farai Chidea and her guest. I must also say that I'm a 45-year-old white male Spaniard.
Muchos, muchos gracias, Jose. Agradecemos a todos que nos escuchan alrededor del mundo.
Very nice, Farai.
It hurt me.
Algo que muchos han tratado.
That's it for letters, but please keep yours coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. Please be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name, and apologies if I butchered any Spanish there. Thanks, Christopher.
Muchos, muchos gracias.
Para un güey, vivo mi vida y diario la reposo. Un par de morros con viejas, pero no esposo. Y me puedes hallar en la calle cualquier tipo, gastando feria con mi equipo. Parece que me hice padre.